ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
This is another jam-packed episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. With us this week is DM168 editor Heather Robertson. Here's what's coming your way. All for show. Why this year's BRICS summit felt rather pointless. Later, why hundreds of medical professionals are fleeing to Canada. Then, society is seemingly calling it quits on news. Why that's a problem.
For example, what happened here with the food story in Gauteng, going off and attacking spaza shops. And then you find that actually the snacks have been checked and there's no poisons in the snacks.
And how one woman's vision reshaped the mental health conversation in South Africa. But first, another girl found dead at the hands of a depraved man. The country recoiled in horror as 6-year-old Amantle Samane was raped and murdered in Orlando East in Soweto last week. She becomes yet another young life lost in the most brutal way imaginable. With a man in custody and court proceedings expected to continue this coming Friday, young Amantle's murder comes as the country grapples with two more court cases involving child trafficking and murder. We look at how these handful of cases serves as a reflection on our very broken society. Welcome back to the show, Heather. How have you been since our last chat? It's been forever.
It's been so busy since our last chat. Wow. I think it was before the elections.
Right? Yes, definitely. Yeah, it was elections.
Our country and our lives have changed.
Now, last week served as really a terrible reminder of just how unsafe many of our most vulnerable children are. We had two big court cases kicking off and yet another beautiful girl found raped and murdered in Soweto. Now, let's first talk about the big case that I think most people have been following, and that's the Jocelyn Smith case. She would have turned 7 years old this past week, and her mom and her co-accused have made another court appearance. And details regarding Jocelyn's disappearance and suspected trafficking have started to come to light. And it's really just horrifying, the details that have come from this case.
You know, the state's case points to Jocelyn's mother and her boyfriend and their friend who plotted her kidnapping and trafficking. At this point, until the judge rules on it, it's all allegation, I guess. But, you know, the absolute horror of your own mother selling you. And there's no sign of this little girl. The state alleges that Jocelyn's mother wanted to sell all three of her children, allegedly to Sangoma, but that hasn't been proven. But that's what's horrific. It's kind of our society is buckling under poverty. I mean, like Jocelyn's mother did work, but what leads you to do that? Is it desperation? Is it addiction? What is it? You know, is it the way you were raised?
But what really gets me is that, according to details set out by the state in last week's court appearance, Jocelyn's mom apparently, this is what the state says, already started planning the alleged sale of Jocelyn back in August of last year already.
I know, it's premeditated.
Yes, so it's not a spur of the moment thing. No. It's not like, oh, I desperately need money to pay off a loan shark or to get my hands on drugs. This has been 6 months in the making. And assuming it's true, for me, I just can't imagine how a mother can look at her own child for 6 months, or at least 6 months, knowing full well that this is what they were planning to do with their daughter. It's just unfathomable for me.
All three, hey? Because in those court papers, she planned to actually sell all three of the children. There's something radically wrong with a society that treats its most vulnerable as commodities, because that's what they are. Selling children, abusing children. It horrifies me.
And then you see cases like this where it just becomes another headline, and then you move on to the next one, and then to the next one. We've become so desensitized to evil, I think, especially in this country.
Yeah. You know, where are our social services? That's the first point. That's where we're failing our children as well, not just that parent. It's like, why are children being neglected and left alone? Yeah, we've got to actually have our institutions working across the spectrum, because they're not. And those kids who fall between the cracks, they need care as well, as much as any other child.
Now, another horrific case that kind of reflects more on the evil aspect of it more than parenting or social services is the terrible case of 13-year-old Klavert boy Jerobian van Wyk, who was allegedly murdered and disposed of by 58-year-old Daniel Smit, who basically said in court this past week that they stole mangoes from him. He tried to discipline them. They laughed at him and then he got mad. And that's why he went into this rage and just chased after them.
I don't think we addressed this. South Africa is a giant gaping wound. There's a lack of empathy. I was reading the crime stats. Most of the causes of violent conflict in South Africa is rage. It's road rage. It's the violence of men against women. It's drinking too much alcohol. And then how is that? It's absolute rage. It's an inability to actually know yourself, walk away, go and calm yourself down. That's the walking damage, in every sphere, rich and poor, white, black, colored, whatever. It's everywhere. It's that we're not embracing our gentleness, our vulnerability, our ability to care, to subside our rage and actually see the other human across the table from us. It's very disturbing. It's terribly disturbing.
This past week, Russian President Vladimir Putin made his return to the global stage as the country hosted 36 leaders at the 16th BRICS summit. While the global West fumed at the notion of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres attending the annual meeting, Russia in turn made it clear. The West will not prevent it and other BRICS member countries from shaping the future of the international order. And despite Putin using the summit to largely show that he's not the international pariah many have made him out to be, there's one label he won't easily shake, that of aggressor. Let's move on to politics and, from a highly emotive topic to something that's equally emotive on a different level. And that is, of course, the 16th BRICS summit that wrapped up last week in Russia. Now, overall, the focus was largely on anti-Western sentiment, as countries like Russia and China accused the West of really holding double standards and abusing economic tools, saying that the sanctions are being used to bully them into obedience. And then we also have on the local front Ramaphosa, who once again reiterated the importance of world peace. But a lot of people have noted that conveniently he left out the ongoing Ukraine-Russia war in his address. I read someone said that this year's BRICS summit was more about optics than anything else, really.
Yeah, I'm in a nook and then, of course, the big split with John's DNA is and obviously climbing into Ramaphosa saying he doesn't speak for me because Russia's not our friend, not a friend of the West because of Ukraine. And then again, we have that polarization, even within the DA, obviously is aligned to America and the Western countries, the European countries. It's almost like what the non-aligned movement was in the pod, except that it's not really non-aligned because with Russia in particular, pushing its narrative or wanting to actually do business by starting something other than the SWIFT code for international transactions. The thing is, Russia has been an aggressor. Russia has invaded Ukrainian territory, and they'll go back into history about actually it was originally part of Russia, as Israel is doing. These wars that are growing into world wars are deeply troubling. If we were truly non-aligned and not partisan to Russia, for example, we are a member of BRICS. And I think that is a good thing because there is dominance by the Western countries, by the USA and Europe. And the amount of trade that there is between all the expanded BRICS countries is of benefit to us. And if we are a neutral party and we are calling for peace in Ukraine, in Israel and Palestine, call me a peacenik or naive. I think that is a good place to be, but you've got to be wary of being perceived to be taking sides if you want to be a true peace broker.
But I understand we have a lot more to lose. So we do have to kind of
really balance alliances and so forth. But in the process, we have to also ensure that we don't lose that humanitarian facade, so to speak, that we've built up since 1994 and being sort of at the forefront of fighting for justice and human rights and all of that. So it's a very difficult line to straddle for our country, I think.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And especially as our government is straddling a diverse line as well, it's not a dominant majority party government anymore.
Canada has a problem. It's facing a severe shortage of doctors, with the country expected to have a shortfall of at least 44,000 physicians by the year 2028. So, what does this have to do with South Africa? Everything. Because as Canada entices hundreds of South African doctors to cross the ocean and relocate, our already overburdened healthcare system is struggling to cope with the mass exodus.
But I want us to focus now on some local news, and we need to talk about our doctors, more specifically the ones leaving the country. I came across a very interesting report out of Canada that showed how hundreds of our doctors and nurses are choosing this country specifically, Canada, to move to. According to the report, between January 2020 and July of this year, Canada issued around 7,700 temporary work permits to South Africans, and of those, 600 are healthcare professionals. That's just one country, really, if you look at the statistics. Obviously,
a lot of nurses are going to England, caregivers are going to England because they don't value them here.
Yes. And the big popular thing to say now is that, oh, doctors are fleeing because of NHI and they want to get out before that. But that's only part of it, because if you really look at some of the reports and the research that has been done in the last decade, this has been a problem for a long time coming. And it's certainly, I think NHI was the thing that kind of tipped the scales for many.
Yeah. I mean, look, I went to my podiatrist a few months ago, and he was telling me how the people who actually make the prosthetics for your feet, how there's only one left in the country because the others have immigrated, and they're probably to Australia or something like that. So it is a problem. But look, it's a problem of we have a thriving private sector, and I think that private sector that definitely feels the threat of the NHI, the bullheadedness of people like the new health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, former home affairs minister, not really wanting to compromise on anything, I think is causing doctors to flee. So that at the end of the day, you'd have an NHI, but not the medical skills to actually to run it or to serve in it. But there is also another thing, and it's doctors also go where the money is. If they think they can earn more in Canada, and also easier to go to Canada because they don't have to rewrite all the entrance exams, etc., because they're readily accepted. But the other side of it is that Canada also has an NHI, and that's where they'll be working. And it's also the reason Canada needs all these foreign doctors is because it's also buckling under the pressure of too few doctors and health workers. You know, it's quite a conundrum, eh? Because the thing is, if I look at, the amount of our doctors are really well trained here. Our nurses are really well trained here, and they get great experience here. But they'll do the internship or the community service, and then a lot of them go. That's okay. Get experience everywhere in the world. But the point is, maybe perhaps if you are doing that, that country should pay back the country that trained those doctors. That there should be some way of pouring that money back into bursaries for the next level so that we actually don't run out. For example,
an exchange program of some sorts where at least there's some return, whether it's you're exchanging skills or you're exchanging resources.
But I mean, the thing is, it's like these are wealthy first world countries. We are a really struggling, unequal, developing country. And the point is that we're training youngsters really well, and then we're exporting them. And the investment, I mean, how much does it actually cost for this country to invest in and all the medical training is, I can't think of a single private institution. It's all government institutions, every one of them. It's the University of Pretoria, it's Madunsa, it's University of KZN, it's the University of Stellenbosch, it's UCT, it's the University of Witwatersrand, and now there's a medical center at Nelson Mandela University. Come on, these are all funded by the state and by taxpayers. So our money is being rapidly expatriated and serving the first world. For me, that's the biggest tragedy of this exodus.
I know in a recent story that we did on the insane budget cuts happening on provincial level, especially the health and the education sectors are being impacted by this. And one of the experts that we spoke to said, you know, one simple step in the right direction would be for government to actually properly reevaluate the way it spends its money. Because right now you have money being spent on massive cabinets and on fancy cars and fancy houses. And instead, that money can be poured into the sectors that matter most. That is a pretty simple step to take.
Yeah. Now, there's been a call for that. There's something they call zero-based budgeting. So actually, what is the need? Start from there. Rather than just like increase, you know, 10%, like all these civil servants. It's like, where is the need? So there needs to be like a whole restructuring, reorganization, proper process management from the ground up. Yeah, it just seems to be a lack of creativity. It's like everything is like a lumbering bureaucracy rather than coming up with better ideas of making good with what we have. Because I do think we have a lot. Like, why are our medical professionals some of the best in the world? Because we have these resources. We have good medical schools. We have good doctors and nurses. But they are being run off their feet, overworked, because of terrible management. So it is messed up. But I do think there are some really amazing people in our public health system that are trying. But they're hitting brick walls from bureaucrats. Yes.
Globally, interest in news has been steadily declining for the past decade. This despite online platforms providing greater access to various news sources. A recent survey done by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism shows how the volume of Google searches for news-related content has tumbled to its lowest levels in more than 10 years. In addition, almost 4 in 10 people are actively blocking out news or avoiding it some of the time. Back at home, a report by the Competition Commission as part of its Media and Digital Platforms Market Inquiry, or MDPMI, shows how South African trends are following suit. So, what does this all mean in an era of fake news and rage baiting?
I want to hear from you, Heather. Where do you get your news from mostly?
Well, I work for the Daily Mavericks.
Of course, yes.
Okay, but I'll be honest. I get it from the Daily Maverick, and then I get it from News 24. I also get it from the Mail and Guardian, and I get it from Times Live. And
So traditional media, mostly.
And the Sweden. Well, for me, it's trusted media.
Yes.
I know I can trust the sources of media. I know that they all belong to the press council. I know that if anything goes wrong, they will subject themselves to the scrutiny of the press council. They will correct or apologize. And so, yeah, I go for trusted media.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. Obviously, I start my mornings with Daily Maverick and News 24 and Netwerk 24 because the Afrikaans news is sometimes pretty damn interesting. Yep. And then also, I keep my eye and ear on TV and radio news throughout the day. And it's the same with me. I feel that there's a certain level of fact-checking that was most likely done before a story is published. But I found in recent years that social media has become a crucial addition to my news consumption. It seems many other South Africans are doing exactly the same. In fact, more South Africans now are relying on social media, that's Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, instead of immediately referring to the traditional trusted media that's been around for decades. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I find it very scary because, let's just face facts that we in the traditional media use Facebook, Google to actually distribute our news. So people, when they look in their Google fields, they'll search for something and they'll find us, News 24, Daily Maverick, whatever, in the traditional field. But what I find terribly scary is when people sharing their opinions on Facebook and like declaring that something's happened to them and that hasn't been fact-checked. And it's a whole lot of rubbish, hogwash. And then, for example, what happened here with the food story in Gauteng, going off and attacking spaza shops. And then you find that actually the snacks have been checked and there's no poisons in the snacks. So depth And the culture of reading and literacy is evaporating in front of our eyes. But everything is so, like, on social media, it's knee-jerk. And the thing is, it's like, okay, players, okay, politicians, directly push their stuff on X and then people consume it. It's not being interrogated. It's not being mediated. That's what we, the media, do. We mediate, we interrogate, we question. And now even to be seen to question or interrogate, then you get all these trolls coming in like trashing journalists.
Exactly. And, you know, in terms of media literacy, this MDPMI report from the Competition Commission touched on that fact as well. And in the survey, a large amount of people said, you know what, I very rarely actually go ahead and actually read up on something or read an actual article, because if I feel the headline and the little blurb that comes with it gives me enough information to form an opinion, I'm not going to read any further on it. And that for me was shocking, because how you have mis- and disinformation just spreading unchecked. I refer to it as drive-by news consumption, because it's almost like if it comes across your feed, then you consume it. But any other way, you won't go out of your way to go look for the information to try and figure out, form an opinion.
You know, it's exactly what you say. Reading a headline so I can have an opinion, and then you go on and you share that opinion. And that opinion is only based on the headline. It's not based on the nuance and the interviews of the whole lot of people in the whole article. You find most online articles probably are read for about at maximum 30% is read. But most people actually just read the headline and the blurb, or just the headline. And to read for an opinion reminds me of something my 19-year always says to me. It's like, you're listening to respond. You're not listening to understand me. And I was like, whoa. That's amazing. It's true. So people are reading to respond, reading to have an opinion, reading one line to have an opinion, not to understand.
In 1994, South Africa entered a new democratic era filled with promise and possibility. But it was also a time of great anxiety, with many South Africans on edge as our first democratic government took shape. It was at this crucial time that an organization, now synonymous with mental health support, began its work in assisting countless citizens in better dealing with the emotional fallout of decades of oppression, violence, and prejudice. Now, 30 years later, the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, or SADAG, has become an integral part of our country's complex story. And it's all thanks to one woman.
You know, I must say that today's conversation, it's given me a bit of anxiety, I'll be honest.
I'm sorry.
That's perfect, because our final segment is actually about a fantastic group that can help with anxiety, if that's what you need. And this is, of course, SADAG. I never knew this about the organization. I actually came across this beautiful article on Becky Sisa detailing the history of SADAG and its founding in 1994, and specifically focusing on the woman who really founded the organization, Zanae Wilson. And she's just amazing. The more I read about her, the more I was like, this woman is phenomenal. For me, what really stood out is that in that article, the very first thing that the journalist writes is that she says that before she could even start the interview, Zanae immediately asked her, firstly, tell me, how are you doing today? And I just felt that is so beautiful. Yeah. And that just absolutely epitomizes what SADAG is all about. Yeah. So this was just such a phenomenal story.
I mean, like, she came from, this woman is phenomenal. And she came from like a working class area in England. She's 21 years old. And then she comes here and like sets up many different businesses and, you know, what a go-getter. And then experiences a panic attack and it doesn't find any help anywhere. And then when she tries, goes to Canada, because all over the world can't find help. And then she finds the help back in South Africa from a doctor who actually got it and prescribed medication. And then she sets up this organization. I mean, wow, how many South Africans, 1994, I know I suffered massive panic disorder because it was so violent and so on edge. And people flooded and there she was, and she started this organization that is still going strong. It's incredible.
Yes. I think a lot of us maybe turned to them during COVID-19.
Yes.
You know, that as well. And I mean, SADAG has been on the forefront of many, many battles on behalf of mental health and the people affected by it. I mean, we've had them with Life Isidemeni. They were one of the very first people to issue warnings to. Yeah, they said, listen, the Gauteng Department of Health needs to slow down. You're endangering lives. This is not going to work. And unfortunately, as we know now, the department never listened. But I mean, they were there fighting for the people of Life Isidemeni as well and representing and supporting the families throughout, right up until this very day. They're still supporting those families. It is such an amazing organization that is so central to the, I almost feel like to the fiber of South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. And also mental health is so, I mean, as she was saying, that there's such a negative stigma attached to it. And yet, like, I've been for help with trauma counselors, and how relieved you feel once you get to deal with it and understand what's going on. And that our bodies physically are affected by the trauma that we experience around us and how to heal that. So they play an incredible role. They are like truly unsung heroes of this country.
Absolutely. Well, on that inspiring note, that brings us to the end of today's show. This has been such a great chat, but unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. And thank you so much, Heather, for taking the time to chat to us.
Great chatting to you, Liz.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.